Hi, everybody. My name is Merv, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Merv.
Wow, that was quick. That was way quick. And my sobriety date is June 1st, 2001. So by the grace of God, a lot of inconvenience, commitments, remaining sponsorable. You know, I still have a few days to go, you know, but I'll be celebrating 16 on Thursday. And that still baffles my mind, you know. I'm part of a strong home group in Charlottesville, Virginia. My home group is the Common Solution Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30. We're a wacky bunch, but we have a lot of fun. We're a well-structured meeting, and we're definitely all-inclusive. We're a good meeting, and I love my home group, and I'm definitely a home group guy. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I have sponsees. I work with guys, and then I have guys who call me sponsor. And I don't know if I sponsor them or not, but they think I do. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you know, go out and try it for a while, and you'll figure out what I'm talking about. And yeah, and I just got a new guy, and it's been a while. It seems my MO these days, as far as working with other alcoholics, I get the guys who lost their sponsor, you know. And the last four guys that I picked up, their sponsors disappeared. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh, my God, I got to go to that crotchety one-eyebrow guy in Charlottesville and ask him to work with me, you know. And so it's nice to get a new guy, you know, and we're going through the book page by page, and we're doing everything he tells us to do. And whenever it says ask, we pray. And he's a great kid. I still got to deprogram some of the treatment center stuff out of him, but he's a willing cat, you know. And we had a long talk about, you know, there's a phrase in the big book. It says, you know, to live it or to die as an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And, you know, and it wasn't. And it wasn't for a long time, you know. It's kind of like in sobriety, you know. You go through those pitfalls in sobriety and the same thing. The same questions asked, but it's a different phrase. It's whether God is everything or God is nothing and what is our answer to be. And I found that in both of these propositions that there is no door number three. There is no choice number three. And a lot of my story on how I got here, you know, was me just getting to that place where I realized that there absolutely wasn't a door number three, that I was faced with an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. You know, all through my life, you know, especially whenever I started losing the effect that alcohol gave me. Like, you know, we all have that story, you know, and for me, I had three older sisters who went off to college and I was one of those guys who, you know, like didn't want to be a drinker. I met my grandfather on my dad's side the day before he died of cirrhosis. And then my mom moved my grandfather and her dad in, and I watched him die the alcoholic death the last 3 years of his life. And make no bones about it, you know, I mean, I think I maybe had been suffering from untreated alcoholism, but I didn't want any part of it because I got a real good glimpse of what alcoholic death was. And I didn't want to drink or nothing, but when my three older sisters, you know, came home, it was like one of those spells, like, you know, summer had just started. I survived another school year in my little farm town of Pennsylvania, and I was the overweight kid. Definitely didn't connect with nobody. I think I had one friend. I mean, I drove a Pinto, you know, that should sum it up. And, you know, and I lived in a trailer park, you know, I mean, we were not well off. Dad was always gone and mom was always up in Five East, you know, and, you know, so right away, you know, long before I took my first drink, I was hiding myself. The double life had already appeared. You know, I tried to play this part of what everybody wanted me to be in school and in, you know, close contact relationships. But underneath, you know, I was already feeling difference. Now, I didn't know at the time, I was just mad. I mean, whenever I get scared, man, I just get mad. And I was the kid in school who was always trying to punch holes in cinder block walls because I just had the inability to communicate at all with anybody. I didn't know how to relay feelings. I didn't know how to talk to, you know, anybody and be genuine. Everything had to come through this secondary facade of this life that I was pretending to be. And I was still hanging on to that. I was hanging on to that. And then my three older sisters came home, and they had this little brother and this little bondage of self brother. And they knew they needed to get him out, and they wanted to do something, and they didn't know what to do. I mean, there's like 15 bars in my hometown of Walmart, and that's it, right? And they were like, hey, let's go out. There's some DJ playing like some really bad 80s you know, music and let's put on our big hair and you can drive us around. And I said, okay. So we went out, we went to this place and they all got their drinks and the bartender came down to me and looked at me and said, what are you going to have? And without batting an eye, I said, I'll take a double Jim Beam and Coke. And when we talk about freedom of the bondage itself, you know, the treat, that untreated alcoholism thing, and I think we all had this moment where we hit the bullseye, and that time was the bullseye. Like, whenever I drank that drink down and then got another, man, something happened. It was like, you know, the fears in this, like, crusty version of the world had washed away. And all of a sudden, I could start to see, like, my sisters as human beings. All of a sudden, I mean, and I'm not kidding, I think I laughed genuinely the first time that night. I had a blast. I mean, I was, like, having fun, dancing, high-fiving. I mean, you name it. I mean, I'm sure I made a spectacle out of it. I'm sure that I embarrassed them. But for me, this was something new. And what it did for me was, is even though I didn't become a daily drinker right away, but it started to become an idea that I need to get some more of this stuff whenever I can get it. And I'll tell you, and what alcohol did for me and how it treated my alcoholism, this fear to connect, this fear to be one with other people, this living in Merv's little world, what it did for me was by the time I was a senior in high school, I was dating a prom queen, I was president of my class, voted most likely to succeed. And that wasn't Merv. That was the effect of alcohol releasing Merv from his little world, and all of a sudden I was able to go out and play. And whenever they say you had arrived, I had arrived. Like, that was it. And by the time I was 19, drinking myself out of college in my first year, I'll tell you what, the progression of alcoholism was already starting to be evident. Throughout my drinking career, I've done everything everybody in this room has done. You know, I've tried to relocate. I moved to New York. I opened up a punk club at 21 in Savannah, Georgia. I moved back to New York, moved to Winchester. I just kept moving around. It was generally on the heels of some kind of, you know, activity. You know, I mean, I got a couple of DUIs along the way, but generally what started to happen was is this newfound Merv that I wanted everybody to see, this easygoing, you know, this intelligent being, this guy who would go out and do anything for anybody. What started to happen was I started to accumulate all this stuff in my closet that would never be thought of to be shared with another human being. I mean, we're talking about bad stuff going down on prom night. We're talking about, you know, some petty theft. We're talking accidental killing of animals. We're talking, you know, and it just, the list starts growing. And what happened was, is even though I moved away, sooner or later I'd look in the mirror and I realized I was still there. You know, and my opinion of myself deep down inside became lessened and lessened. And, you know, my alcoholism progressed, and I remember Tom Flynn from Baltimore saying, you know, that you started getting a series of direct hits that would start awakening your mind that there might be something going on here. And the way I look at it for me is I started having collisions of the double life, right? I have this facade of what I want everybody to see me as, and then all of a sudden, Merv the loser would show up, or Merv the drunken debauchery hitting on your girlfriend guy would show up. That guy would show up, and then all of a sudden there would just be a calamity. There would be a big hit, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm waking up, you know, and I'm like looking in the mirror, and it's getting tougher, and I'm like, you know, it's just getting tougher, and I just know, you know, I mean, maybe I do have a little bit of a drinking problem, but I'm not sure. What I know is I just basically can't stand who I'm turning into, you know, incrementally. And you know, and even though alcohol was a solution to my alcoholism, but now it started to turn to a different way. And what it started to do was I needed it. It became more of a necessity in my life because the more stuff I had piling up, the more fear I would have, the more fear of what everybody thought of me. And then most importantly, the remorse of the stuff I had done. I needed something to treat that, you know. For a long time, whenever I thought about my two grandfathers, you know, I thought they had a drinking problem, but now I realize that they weren't drinking, you know, basically to like have fun. That they were basically drinking to cover up because they were powerless over it. They needed to drink in order to basically remove themselves from untreated alcoholism. And the way I know this is because whenever problems would start to pile up, my MO would always be I would go in the wagon, right? And for me, the most torture and agony that I ever suffered from alcoholism happened whenever I wasn't drinking. You know, I thought maybe I might have a drinking problem. But now I realize that I have a not drinking problem. And the thing is how that shows up is like, okay, I'm on the heels. I just wrecked another car. I got another DUI. And now it's time. I got to put the plug in the jug. You know, I got to stop drinking. And once the heat's off, right, what happens to me is like, you know, I feel good for a little bit. And then slowly I start to notice what's wrong with everybody else around me. The job is no longer good. I can't stand anybody there. All of a sudden, I'm looking at the then wife, and there's something wrong with her. I should have never gotten this relationship in the first place. I'm trying to brush my teeth, but I can't look at myself because I got all this stuff in my past that's starting to crawl up my spine, and I'll tell you what, I can't look at myself no more. And then it's just like, and then I know that mom and dad, they don't want nothing to do with me. And then the loneliness, and I'll tell you, loneliness is a killer. And then all of a sudden, I just can't stand how I feel. And it's so paramount, and it polarizes my mind that I need to do something about that, and I need to do it right now. And that's power sober alcohol, because this time it's going to be like high school. This time it's going to be like when I was 17. I'm going to be able to drink 8 and put it down and get home safely. But I'll tell you what, there ain't no stopping at 8. Because, man, once I start drinking, man, there is no return. I drink till I'm blacked out, passed out, or the cops are coming. And that came at an early age, and I tried to hang on. I mean, I tried to hang on for a long time. Like I said, you know, my family, my mom and dad, you know, it's pretty bad, you know. And I got this more from working with other guys, and I got it from looking back at my life and pondering, you know. And when you're dying the alcoholic death, you know, I mean, whenever you're suffering from alcoholism, you know, I'm so selfish and self-centered that I think it's just about me. And I don't realize that the living hell I'm putting my family through while I'm doing that, or her, you know, or what I'm doing to the people in the workplace, because I can't, like, you know, I can't act right. Everything comes out with an anger filter for me. And, man, and I'm working with this guy, and I'll tell you, you know, I mean, man, he's suffering it, and I identify. I was like, man, I was right where you were. Family doesn't want nothing to do with you, you know, and I had a good glimpse of my dad, you know, and my mom. Like I said, I didn't grow up in the Cleaver household, you know, but my mom was quick to use the term alcoholic. You know, she labeled my dad as an alcoholic. And, you know, and what happened was, while I'm declining rapidly, the progression's like moving right along, like I'm in bad shape. My dad stopped shrinking. I mean, he quits. Doesn't go to shrink, doesn't go to church, doesn't go to AA, doesn't get on any meds, doesn't go to a therapist. He stops. And after about a week of DTs, you know, he starts to get his life together. And soon, after about 6 months, he's happy and sober. You know, and I never could understand that. I couldn't understand how dad stopped drinking and then his life got happy and sober. And in my keen alcoholic of mine, what I did was I equated that to like, okay, if you stop drinking, your life's going to get better. And for a long time, while I'm suffering from alcoholism, just trying not to drink, waiting for my life to get better, man, it's getting way worse. I mean, now I'm thinking about killing myself on a daily basis. You know, it's just like I'm over at a friend's house trying to figure out what they got in the medicine cabinet. I mean, it's bad stuff, right? And what happened was is I found out who my dad was. You know, when I finally got sober and I started reading the book with a sponsor, I found out, because it describes the three different types of drinkers. You got the temperate drinker, you know, who, you know, can have one every once in a while. You know, maybe it's a little bit like my sister. She has one blackout, does something embarrassing, doesn't need to drink anymore. And then you have the heavy drinker who looks a lot like us, right? Gets in trouble drinking. You know, sometimes they can't stop. But what happens is they have the power to stop drinking on their own human basis. If, you know, like a warning from a doctor or a family change or an atmosphere change. And that's what happened to my dad. They found a spot on his liver. He had a grandbaby. And then all of a sudden he stopped and he got happy and sober. So I threw that away in my keen alcoholic mind. And I'm just like, well, if I stay stopped long enough, I'll be happy and sober. You know, and that day never came. because whenever what happened was is whenever I read the next part, I realized that I was different than my dad. I just cannot not drink. And what I am the hopeless alcoholic. And for years and years of coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, seven of them, you know, I've like even joined like big book groups and I get a sponsor and pretend that I was paying attention and, you know, I lost my train of thought. But whenever I would like do this stuff, you know, it would be like I'd be waiting around for something to happen. But I realized that I wasn't going to, you know, that for some reason my dad was able to maintain this and I couldn't. So, you know, a lot of my story, you know, is just the same thing, you know, with different consequences along the way. I've tried, you know, I mean, I've had those moments like where I never wanted to drink again. I was in a jet ski accident on my first date with my soon to be wife, you know, I got out of a coma in 30 days and I came to in that hospital bed, that girl was sitting next to me and I couldn't believe it. And I looked over at her and I didn't say, "Hey, thanks for coming here to see me." You know, I didn't acknowledge her. I looked at her and the first words out of my mouth after coming to was, "I never want to drink again." And she was just like, "Hey, you know, whenever you get out of here, maybe you can get some help and stuff like that." You know, we talk about this, you know, the line we cross and that we're the point of no return. And I don't know where that line was for me, but I see the evidence here is because whenever I got out, it was 2 days later, I'm still in liquor out of a liquor cabinet again, you know, and I'm doing this stuff. And for me to land in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I think, you know, one of the blessings that I got were the 7 years that I was coming in and out, and I wasn't doing what you guys were telling me to do. You know, I felt disconnected. I think, you know, for me, what saved me a lot, along with identification, the thing that saved me, too, was the singleness of purpose. Because whenever I came in here, you know, I didn't really know what was wrong with me. You know, I knew that I drank too much. I knew that I got in trouble. I went to a lot of well-meaning doctors. And whenever I came in here, I had seven different diagnoses. You know, I mean, I was bipolar. I was alcoholic. I was an addict. I was a marijuana addict. I was a sex addict. I was an SLA. And you could probably throw a chronic masturbator in there, too. And every time I crack that joke, I always remember Sam. The first time he heard it, he came up to me and told me how much he identified with my story. And so whenever I got here this time, you know, I think the heels of the consequences, you know, like, I mean, I wasn't feeling good. I mean, you know, she was going to leave again, and it was another wrecked car. And you know, I had nowhere else to go, you know, was basically it. And 2 weeks before I got sober, I heard somebody say something, you know, and they said you never have to drink again if you do certain things. And it was a person over 7 years I've grown to loathe in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I'd have to show up in a meeting and get another white chip or something like that, it was always a smiley guy, you know, talking about God. And talking about, you know, steps and commitments in AA and getting a home group and giving back, you know. And I hated this person. And I hated them because I wasn't doing the damn thing they were doing, you know. And I was just like, but whenever I heard them say that about a week before I got sober, it stuck. And whenever I got out of jail 2 times in 3 days, you know, for drunk in public, you know, I'll tell you. I take that road. I volunteer in that jail now, you know, on Monday nights. And every time I pass this little convenience store, you know, I thank God, you know. Because whenever I came back and I'm walking from jail, you know, and if you don't know where this is, there's a lot of hills, right? And I'm sweating it out, and I know this convenience store, so I have hope, right? I have a little bit of hope, even though I'm dying inside. And something happened because I went in and I got a 22 of Bud Light. And I sat behind that dumpster and started crying, and I couldn't keep that Bud Light down. And I knew the consequences were heavy. I knew I had shame and remorse, but really it was something inside that clicked. You know, I knew that my life was never going to get better. I knew it was never going to get better. And I couldn't stand the life that I was living up to this point. I just couldn't take it. And I knew that not drinking, I mean, I was ready to kill myself. you know. And I knew something drastic had to change. And whenever, then that voice popped in my head, you know, you never have to drink again if you do certain things. And then some magic happened. And it wasn't me. And I think there was a series of God events in my life. And looking back, I can pinpoint them. I can smile and I can thank them. But in the moment, I don't know what's going on, right? I called this person up. And this person, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, was going to a AA conference, a weekend job, and then was going to go on vacation. And I called this person up. It was a Friday. And I was like, I need some help. And they knew who I was. And they're like, look, get to the Friday 5:30 speaker meeting. Get there. And then I'm going to pick you up. And I didn't know any of this stuff until after the fact, but they canceled everything. And they took me in their house. And it was just like a scene from Bill and Bob, you know, like it was our Abby and Bill. And it was the same scene, you know. And they went in there and we sat down and, you know, I got my white chip and we went back and they started talking about their drinking. And I'm like, yeah. Once you start drinking, you can't control the amount you take. You don't know where you're going to show up. And they're like, yeah. And then what they did was they started talking about this peculiar mental twist, the agony of untreated alcoholism, which is just not drinking. And then it doesn't matter that you just burn your life to the ground, the thoughts and feelings that bring you to taking that first drink, you know. And they started talking about that stuff in really understandable terms. And I was like, man, I said, I get that. I said, that's what I got. That's what's wrong with me. And they're like, congratulations, you're an alcoholic. And, you know, and it's just like the old story goes, you know, and, you know, I came to believe in the futility of the life I was living. And then I also came to believe that if I do what this person does, I might have what they have. And that's a happy sobriety. And it was just like that. And they made no bones about it. You know, they said, Merv, you know, I've been watching you for 7 years. And you're always coming in on the heels of something, you know, and it seems like it's getting quicker. And I was like, yeah, you know, it is coming quicker. And they explained to me, and it was just like, Merv, every alcoholic has a fuse, you know, and you've used your fuse up. You don't get a free grace period no more. You know, what you need to do is you need to start doing some stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they read me the list. They were like, you know, it's up to you whether or not you're going to be sponsorable, you know. And what they said was, are you willing to go to a meeting every day? And I said, yes. They said, are you willing to carry this message to another alcoholic because that's the only reason I'm taking you through it? And I said, yep. And they said, are you willing to get on your knees? And I said, yep. And they were saying, you know, the most important tool in your spiritual toolkit is going to be the ability to say yes to a sponsor and yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you going to be able to do that? And I said, yeah. And they said, all right, we're well on our way. You know, because there was plenty of times, you know, the God idea chased me out of AA a bunch. You know, I didn't want any part of that, you know. And it's not like I had a punishing God. I just, you know, didn't want to give my life over to the care of anything. You know, I was the one to run the show, you know. And they made it simple for me. They were like, you know, they just made it real easy for a guy like me because they knew I'm bullheaded. Instead of like, you know, giving me an answer, is God everything or is God nothing? They were like, Merv, let's just simplify this down. Is AA going to be everything or is AA going to be nothing? And I said, I'll make AA everything. And they're like, that's all we need to do. Are you God? I'm like, nope. I said, all right. Now we're going to, you know, go on through the steps. And whenever they started talking, you know, I've been around long enough that I kind of knew what was coming, right? And my biggest fear was the fifth step and the ninth step, you know, and didn't want any part of that stuff. And, you know, and I'll use this analogy. There was a... There was a time in sobriety, I had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, right? And I didn't know I had Rocky Mountain spotted fever. If you don't know what that is, don't get it. You know, I'm here to tell you what. The two major symptoms are you can't sleep, and the other one is you're so sick you want to die, right? So you're up 24 hours a day, and you just want to die. You're so sick. And then all of a sudden, these splotches start showing up on my body, and I'm like freaking out. So I go to the doctor, right? And this is alcoholic behavior at the best. I go to the doctor, and I'm like, I don't know what's wrong with me. And the doctor's like giving me the examination. He's like, well, you have Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And I'm like, what's that? He's like, it's a tick disease, and you can die. And I was like, What are you talking about? I don't have this. I have the flu or something. And I'm looking at this doctor who's been practicing medicine for 40 years, and I'm like telling him that he's wrong, right? So he's like, well, okay, you know, I can give you some meds right now. And I'm like, nah, I got this, right? I got this. So I go home and start looking up Rocky Mountain spotted fever on Google. And, man, there's, like, people getting gangrene, limbs are falling off, it's gruesome, right? And then I look down the list and of the I look down the list of the symptoms, and it says, so sick you want to die and you can't sleep, you know, basically. And I'm like, oh my God, that's what I got, you know? And so I went so I made a decision that I was going to go to the doctor, and then I followed up with action. And what I did was I got the medicine and I took it, right? And to this day, I still have Rocky Mountain spotted fever. I get bad enough, it's coming back, right? And that's the way I had to look at it. You know, is if I have this terminal illness, and the only way that I'm going to, like, have a happy life and stay on this planet is a spiritual basis of recovery. You know, I didn't know what I was turning my life and my, or I didn't know what I was turning my will and my life over to the care of, but like Bob Darrell says, I had to get it out of the hands of this idiot, right? Mm-hmm. And that's basically what I had to do. So I knew that once I made this decision, that a decision is only as good as the action that I followed up with. And I knew what was coming, and I had the horror show already recycling in my head. And I'm an alcoholic, and I got my feet dug in. And, you know, God showed up. Now, I didn't know. He didn't come knocking on my door, right? He didn't say, hey, Merv, this is God, and I have a plan of action for you. What happened was, saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous then and continually will save my bacon. And what happened was, I was at a meeting. I was a noontimer, you know, and there's 80 people in this meeting. And the guy at the end of the meeting is like, you know, raises his hand, has an announcement. I have to go on a 12-step call, and I need a volunteer to go with me. So, you know, I hear this, and I go back, and, you know, coffee makers make it, right? So I'm, like, cleaning up my coffee pot, like, and I'm cleaning it up, and this guy comes up and taps me on the shoulder. He's like, nobody wants to go. You're coming. And I'm like, 60-day sober guy, man. I don't know what I'm going to be able to do to help you out. He's like, I just need you there. And so, you know, I'm going up the elevator, you know, to 5 East, and I'm like, God, you know, my life stinks. You know, I just lost the money. I lost the wife. I'm basically sleeping over at a friend's house. I don't have money. I got fired on my first day of sobriety from the law firm I worked at, you know, and I'm unemployable. And I'm like, man, my life's already starting to become about me again, right? And I go up there, and all of a sudden we're standing there, and I'm looking down, and there's a guy there that looks like my dad. And he's dying. And this guy's, like, doing his best to comfort him and 12-step him. And every once in a while he'd look over to me, and I'd be like, AA works, you know? Because that's all I had, right? I didn't have anything else, you know? And something happened. And it was the freedom of the bondage itself. That's what happened. Because whenever I came down that elevator, man, I felt like $1 million. I felt like, you know what, something's going to happen. And I had a little bit more power in me, not Merv power, but power from an outside source that gave me the thought that maybe I need to be honest. Maybe I really do need to give this my best shot. And that's all we ask. That's all I ask of my guys. Give me your best shot. Not your best shot, like back on tour with the Allman Brothers, best shot, but give me your best shot. And this, that's all you need. And I gave him my best shot. And I scribbled all that stuff down. I did my best to fit everything into these columns, and I kind of understood what was going on. I already knew I was a liar, cheat, and a thief. I already knew, you know, I mean, I had a good experience with it, the prayer in between the third and the fourth column of the resentment inventory, and I got a good glimpse of what I'm responsible for. And this is just for me, but they told me, they were like, Merv, there's no part here. We're talking about your responsibilities. You got to disregard the other person entirely. So there is no part here. We're talking about your responsibilities. And I got a good glimpse of all that. And granted, I mean, I'm still newly sober, shaking it out. And all I'm scared about is telling this person about prom night, right? But, you know, I end up hopping a car, and my then sponsor was a speaker up in Jersey. He flew down to Dulles Airport, and I drove up to Dulles Airport, fifth step in the chapel closet. And I came out of that closet, and well, not like that, but I came out of the closet, and I was sitting, you know, and we had to take a pee break, and I went down, and I'm at the urinal, and I'm like all, you know, not feeling great because I'm peeing next to this guy who's talking about prom night, and you know, and I'm just like, I thanked him for his time, and then I drove home, and I didn't feel rainbows and ponies. I didn't feel like the fifth step promises occur in my life. But I talked to him a few years later. He's like, nah, Merv. He's like, man, we saw you change right before our eyes. And I was like, I didn't feel it. He's like, it wasn't for you to feel. It was for us to see. And whenever we see that, it gives us even a deeper glimpse into the existence of God and how it works through the miracle that is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I've had that experience many, many times. You know, I missed my Volvo. God, it was just beat up. I killed two deer with it. I wouldn't give it up. I had a red hood and a silver body, and one of the wheels was lower than the others. I had a Billy Hill car, and but I'll tell you what, man, I heard more fifth steps in that clunker, man. And I'll tell you, and there were just certain times where I was just like, I knew that there was something bigger going on here. I'm not really a part of this. I'm here to witness this, and I'm here to witness this change. And got a guy right now, and I'll never forget it. It was plain as day. The guy who got in that car was not the guy who got out. And, you know, and for me, you know, is God everything or is God nothing? God's everything, you know. And I need to be reminded of that, you know. And character defects is a long story. I got plenty of them, and I brought them all here tonight, especially recently. A lot of change in my life. A lot of things I very uncomfortable with change, very uncomfortable when I'm full of fear. And today, you know, like if I do a spot check inventory, it's easy for me to figure out which one has all the third columns affected. If I have the full thing going, full throttle, my life's being affected in personal relationships, pocketbook, security, and I have them all going on the last 3 months. And I'll tell you, you know, it's been a chore. It's been a chore for me to act better than I feel. It's been a chore for me to wake up and ask God to make the most important person in my life the person standing in front of me. Because, man, when my life gets tough, man, I want to take the helm back. Man, I want to take control. And thank God for remaining responsible in Alcoholics Anonymous. And more so now. I mean, my God, more so now. I'm more aware of how imperfect I am now and how short I am in life now. And my necessity to be reliant upon a power greater than myself now than I ever was at 3 or 7 whenever I bottomed out sobriety. And, you know, and it's just, you know, we all grow, you know. And it's like the book says, you know, the only way we can survive, you know, trials and low spots ahead is by perfecting our spiritual growth through self-sacrifice and working for others. You know, and it's funny how it doesn't say prayer and meditation, you know, because for me, you know, it's an action-based program. And I need to put these principles in action. And the biggest principle I can do to help the world be safer from Merv is to sacrifice my time and my life in Alcoholics Anonymous for somebody else. You know, whenever I can do that and I can get out of self and I can take an interest in somebody else, or I got to go pick that guy up again. He's never going to get it, but I got to pick him up again. I pick him up, and all of a sudden it's rinse and repeat. I feel a little bit better one day at a time. A little bit better one day at a time. All of a sudden, it becomes easier for me to take an interest in my wife one day at a time. I become a better boss again one day at a time. You know, and it's baffling to me. It's baffling how the obsession on how I feel still can be the dominant force in my life. And then whenever I get in those places, man, I have, you know, there isn't, you know, I have defense against the first drink, but sometimes I don't have defense against the first reaction. You know, I can pray and meditate. I'm throwing the kitchen sink in. I got speaker discs, you know, in my car. I'm praying. I keep rubber bands on my wrist. I will be done every time I see him, and I snap myself. I'm pulling out all the tricks. And all of a sudden, you know, somebody comes up and they'll step on my toes, and it's 0 to 60. It's 0 to 60. And I'll tell you, you know, and man, that's why I think amends to me, getting those training wheels and how to be wrong and be okay with being wrong, how to go back and make right and take responsibility for the wrongs I've done. I think it was that first 3 or 4 years of those training wheels in Alcoholics Anonymous, closely monitored by my sponsor, that helped me develop that way of life. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But I always come around as long as I stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The amends portion is my life would not be the life I have now without it. Whenever I was growing up and Mom was going in and out of the institutions, I always made sure that she was fully aware that I wouldn't be the way I am if she would have raised me better. I made her aware of that all the time. My dad was scared to death. He loved me, but he didn't know what to do with me, so he kept me at arm's length. And I ran those people into the ground with my behavior. And my first Christmas in sobriety came around, and I was ready to go back and pay for the porn that I stole. I was ready to go back and do all the money things, and my sponsor was like, no. You know, you need to go back and you need to be a man of Alcoholics Anonymous in your home. You need to go back and at least plant a seed of being a son that maybe you could be. So I went back and I made amends. My dad just shook it off. He was just like, he was still scared of like, of doing anything for me just to react, because all he's known is like a dying son up at this point. And, but you know, we talked a little bit and we became connected because he drove me back from PA to Charlottesville. And we grew a little bit, but, making amends with my mom. And it's so funny how we, you know, we chase this sobriety cookie. We chase it, you know, AA's for us. I'm going to get sober. My life's going to get better. My. But really, I think God played the biggest trick of all on us. I think Alcoholics Anonymous saves everybody around us from us. And I think that's the real deal here. Because whenever I made amends to my mom, I said, Mom, hey, I've been a bastard son. You know, and I gave a general overview. I wasn't going to go into the horror show about her falling down the steps and what happened after. I wasn't going to do that. I could not bring myself to put her back through that stuff. And she looked at me and she said, Merv, if I would have raised you better, you would have turned out better. And I told my mom that she needed to put a plug in that right now. Because something had changed. That prayer between the third and fourth column, something changed. And I left them off the hook. You know, just like the old saying goes in AA, if I want to be left off the hook, I got to let them off first. And it happened. And I left them off the hook and I said, Mom, I said, man, you did the best job you could. I said, you did the best job you could with what you had. I said, I was the person that probably caused a lot of this stuff. You know, and I went on. We tried to have a heart-to-heart. She's crying. I'm just trying to hold it together. And I get home. And I'm happy to tell my sponsor kind of what went down and the freedom that my mom got from that. And he's just like, your amends ain't done. He's like, that's just a start. Said, Merv, the approach in the actual amends is just a seed of what can grow. It's up to you to take the continue actions. And he asked me his questions. He said, what did they say whenever you asked them? You know, how can I make this right? And Dad said, just call them. And Mom said, be around more. He's like, well, congratulations. That's the bare minimum you're going to do. And he had me put the cards in. I didn't miss a holiday. I didn't miss a birthday. And I started calling my dad once a week and talking to my mom once a week, and I go visit. And over time, what happened was is this ideal of what a son should be in my life. Like, I always wanted to be a good kid. And the ideal of what a son would be materialized without me having to work on it. And what I realized, especially with my dad, was, I mean, I have a 14-year-old now, hormones raging, you know. Hey, how you doing? Okay, you know, all right. You know, and what I realized is all my dad ever wanted to be a dad, and I never let him. So, you know, on these phone calls, you know, I would come up with imaginary problems, and he'd just perk right up. He'd be like, oh, yeah. He's just like, back when I was riding with Hell's Angels, you know, and, you know, he'd give me like this general topic like of this principle that he tried to do, but he was doing a great job, and I'd listen to him. And, like, during these things, and then I get to know him. And I would bring, like, problems to him, and it was the happiest he got, you know. And it was a beautiful thing. I got reconnected with my dad. And, you know, as far as like practicing the principles in all my affairs and carrying the message to Alcoholics Anonymous, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, those are big deals to me. I think prayer and meditation, I'm into it. I'm still evolving. I don't know what the right fit is for Myrrh. But the one thing that I do ask God is to make sure to make me fit to help God's kids today. You know, I don't want to become so spiritual that I leave Alcoholics Anonymous like my first roommate in AA. He was too busy meditating, so he didn't go to meetings, then he got drunk. So I understand the necessity of prayer and meditation, but as a useful tool to get me ready to do God's work. And that's the way I approach it. Very simple, very mechanical. And the great thing is like it gets enough out of me so whenever the chips do go down, that there might be a little bit of a buffer zone before Merv like jumps down on your back, you know. But for me, carrying the message is a big deal and practicing the principles. I think the other missing link that, you know, that is profound in my life is the connections that I make in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think actions here will keep me sober, but I think, you know, a connectedness, a conscious awareness of others in Alcoholics Anonymous make me or keep me a little bit more happy and sober than Merv just locked up going to four meetings a week and running out the door. You know, I was brought up in AA that the most important time in the meeting is the 30 minutes before and the 30 minutes after. You know, I was brought up that anybody can sound good in AA for 60 minutes, but what's your home life like? You know, what's your job life like? You know, I was brought up with these principles, you know. And I think 10, 11, and 12 bunched together helped me be better. They helped me be better, you know, in those different areas of life. As long as I stay actively, you know, going up against it. Because if I'm keeping all my commitments in AA, you know, I'm willing to go back and I'm willing to make some rights wrong. I'm willing not to keep up secrets in Myrrh's closet in sobriety. I'm willing to basically go to you with an interest of help. Something happens is that even though Merv can get goofy like he did his last 3 months, you know, I stay in his zip code of serenity. I stay in his zip code of being helpful and useful for another alcoholic. When I first got sober, the person that sat down with me, they told me a promise right out of the gate. And I think they knew I needed to hear it. They said, Merv, whatever horror show of a life you walked into Alcoholics Anonymous with, it's going to be your greatest asset. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they said, when you go through the steps, what the steps are going to be, it's going to be like a spiritual recycling center. All of a sudden, you're not going to like want to talk about it, and then all of a sudden, you won't be able to keep your mouth shut about it to a new guy. And that's so true. You know, and I think most importantly, as long as I stay engaged in that process of 10, 11, and 12, when I steal in sobriety, when I lie and cheat in sobriety, whenever I do something dastardly in sobriety, which I've done, I'm not a poster child for perfection or AA here. And then all of a sudden, if I stay in that zip code, I just succumb to the process, you know, and all of a sudden it will be useful. And I think I'll just give a couple of examples. And I love this guy. I love this guy in AA. You know, I always tell this story and my sobriety story. You know, I used to work for a Greek diner. You know, like my first job in sobriety was washing dishes at the Tip Top, right? And I mean, I'm handling $1 million checks and now I'm handling greasy plates. I wasn't much of a dishwasher, and they moved me up to waiter. My how I feel and my selfishness and self-centeredness started getting the best of me, and I felt that I wasn't getting appreciated enough. So, of course, I started stealing some baklava and eating it without paying for it. And then I realized one day after I get out of a conference, and I'm like, oh, man, I had to tell the sponsor. And I think I've eaten, like, 58 pieces of baklava without paying for it. And he's just like, all right, you got to go back. You got to pay for it. I was like, look, man, Greeks only know two emotions, love and rage. I don't want to be a part of any of that, you know. And he's like, you got to go back. So I okayed it with a then-girlfriend, and she's like, she was tough as nails. You know, she was just like, you want to stay sober or not? And I was like, okay, I'll pay it. And I went back, and I paid for it, and he was very understanding. And then I sold some more, and I paid for it again. And, and I tell this story in meetings of AA all the time just for that, to get the laugh, right? You know, just to tell myself, but to get the laugh. And this guy, I love him. He came up to me after a meeting, and this is a few years ago, and he pulls me outside. And 30 minutes after the meeting, you know, that's where the magic happens. And came up to me, he's just like, hey, man, I just want to tell you something. I was like, what? He's just like, in case you haven't figured it, you know, I've heard that damn baklava story way too many times. And I need to talk to you because I've been stealing in sobriety for 7 years. And I need to know how to get this right. And, you know, and we talked for a long time. We still continue to talk, you know, and now he has a funny story too about stealing tools in sobriety, you know, and, but everything here is useful. Everything's useful. Everything. The more shortcomings you got, man, the easier I'm going to identify with you, man. Those people who get it right, talk about being right all the time. Man, I'm like thinking about myself. Then people are talking about like, man, doing something bad in AA or whatever, you know, like, something dishonest or, you know, coming up short or treating somebody like crap and then how they have to pick themselves up with God and their sponsors help, dust off their britches and get re-engaged in the process. Man, you got my full attention because that's me. That's still me. You know, I need to hear that. And so, you know, everything here is useful for a guy like me. And, you know, for me, I'll just go ahead and I'll tell the old story. And I think, you know, the magic for me is that, you know, even though I suffer from an acute obsession of murder, you know, like I think about me, I think about what's coming down the pipe. I'm imagining conversations 2 years from now, you know, it's just like, you know, I mean, I'm full of nerve, right? And I was in a spell of this. I was in sobriety and I had my son and I was taking my son to a preschool. And, you know, and the fathers had to sit in the preschool, which was cool. It was like a Waldorf thing. So it was all hippy dippy. And I was like into like making baskets and stuff. And so I'm like, you know, thinking about fall time. And I'm thinking about how all the neighbors' trees are all like red and beautiful. And the landscape's beautiful. And I live in this piece of property with nothing but these brown, yellow, ugly trees, right? And I'm thinking about this for 2 weeks. I'm not talking to my sponsor. I'm not talking to nobody, but I buy a chainsaw. And chainsaw's prepped up and ready. And I figured, man, this is the day's coming. And today's the day. So we get out of preschool, and I'm going to take this long way around. And I'll put in some Grateful Dead so he'll fall asleep. I'll be able to carry him in. I'm going to start chopping these damn trees down. And so we're driving along, and I look up in the mountains, and it's beautiful, man. It looks like God's watercolor painting, you know, and I'm like, oh man, that's so awesome. And I just like looking at all these properties, I'm like, man, it's so beautiful. And I'm like, then I'm thinking like yellow brown trees. I'm like, man, they're coming down. And I'm getting close to the house. I look over in this field, and there's like this big like yellow bouquet of flowers out in the middle of nowhere. And it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And what happened was is by the time I turned into my lane, I realized that that bouquet of flowers was my house. And, you know, I pulled in, and obviously I didn't cut them down. But that's what Alcoholics Anonymous continually gives me. If I stay focused on Merv and how I feel, or if I'm willing to hold on to a secret, or I'm not willing to give something away for free and for fun, what happens is it's ugly yellow-brown trees. I'm locked back into Merv's own little version of reality. And what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me, it's a long way for me, too. You know, but there is a process here, and there's a continual process, and it's a continual perception change that I need sometimes on a daily basis, that my life is not a train wreck, that my life is the most beautiful thing. I need a perception change, and I need to be awakened to the answer that God is everything once again in my life, once again. And most importantly, what happens is it's not garbage. It's the most useful asset I have to give to another alcoholic. And I need this stuff. I need it all the time. And I'll just go ahead and close with this, is that on my way up here, I'm about 2 miles, right? And I'm thinking about what I'm going to say, right? And all of a sudden, you know, and I'm driving the speed limit because I'm a spiritual guy. And and all of a sudden, you know, there's a slow person in front of me. I'm behind them. And then all these trucks start pulling up beside me. And I'm like, oh, I'm boxed in. Oh, I'm screwed. And all of a sudden, it's a carny, right? And all of a sudden, there's these three big purple and green dragons, like, looking at me in the driver's side. And then, I guess because Greg Allman died, the Allman Brothers come flying on the radio. And I'm going to be like, my first thought wasn't like there's green dragons beside me. My first thought was like getting ripped. at Allman Brothers shows for 8 years. And I was like, and I just smiled, you know, because my best friend had been texting me all day and just remembering stuff like that. And we don't know if he's an alcoholic or not. He gets to make his own determination on that, right? He was texting me about this pond at the bottom of a hill, like when I used to live, like in a trailer park was up on this hill. And then we'd ride these big wheels down this hill into a T intersection, right? And I mean, we're idiots. And I mean, there was no brake or wheels left on the big wheel, right? You know, it's just like you just had to wreck before you got to the road or you're going to get killed, right? Well, across this road was this crappy old pond. And he was talking about it and just bringing back memories of what we used to do in that pond. It was like a swamp. And what we had this bright idea that we needed to fix the pond. And we kind of like, we were like sixth, seventh grade, so we had kind of an idea what we were supposed to do. So we went in and the inlet was backed up. So we cleared away the rocks and we made like the inlet water. We made it flow actually into the pond and not all around the pond. And, you know, and we noticed after a couple of days that the scum wasn't going away on the pond. And we realized that there's a pipe at the other end that we had to go clear out so the water could actually flow through. And then we did that. And then all of a sudden something started to magically happen slowly, is that the scum started to disappear. And what we did was we went down and we cleaned the area around the pond and we cleaned it up. And all of a sudden this crappy, like, ugly area turned nice. And it became like, you know, and then all of a sudden people started to go there. It became attractive. And I was just like, man, isn't that my life in AA? You know, I have to clear away the debris to recognize that there might actually be something bigger than myself, that pond. But the thing is that the only way that pond's going to stay clear is I have to make sure the channel's clear. That means I have to give it away. If I stay engaged and actively taking an interest and trying my best to help other alcoholics, whether I sponsor them or not, something happens here. And what happens here is I have a useful life. I don't have the megapot. I don't have a jackpot. I don't have money. I don't have the car I want. I have the wife I want. But man, everything's beautiful. It's beautiful. And I don't know if it's attractive or not. What I do know is that whenever I can have a chance and I can step back, I'm truly grateful for the blessing that is Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. Thanks for having me.